This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure to have on the show with me Michael Clare, one of the wisest observers of our energy dependence and a longtime critic of U.S. foreign policy, military policy, and energy policy. Michael Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and the author most recently of Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. A documentary film version of his previous book, Blood and Oil, one of his previous books, is available from the Media Education Foundation at bloodandoilmovie.com. Michael Clare, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Matt, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure's all mine. You weren't surprised, I imagine, by the BP oil spill. Why not?
Well, I can't say I predicted that specific event happening, but what I see is a trend towards increasingly risky and hazardous oil drilling, not only in the Gulf of Mexico, but around the world, as more easy oil is exhausted, more accessible fields are exhausted. The oil companies are going into ever more dangerous areas, and that increases the risk of a blowout or other environmental catastrophe. So something like the BP spill was destined to occur.
You're the author of this extreme oil theory. Explain the theory and how you came up with it.
Okay, well, let's begin by contrasting it with where we used to be. At the onset of the oil age, or the great days of the oil age after World War II, we had loads of easy oil. Oil that was in giant reservoirs in Texas and Saudi Arabia, in the North Slope of Alaska and so forth. Oil that was close to the surface in large reservoirs, easy to tap into, cheap to produce, plentiful. And that's what made the great economic expansion of the 20th century possible, and the suburbanization of America, the internal combustion engine, the car, all of that based on cheap and abundant oil. Well, that era is now over. There is no more easy oil to be had. All the easy reservoirs have been depleted. So all that's left is tough oil or extreme oil, oil from very difficult to tap into reservoirs, far offshore, deep underground, in environmentally hazardous areas like the Arctic, or in politically hazardous areas like Nigeria's Niger Delta, where there's a war on, or Iraq, places like that. So we're in the era of extreme oil because that's all that's left if we continue our addiction to petroleum.
And Michael Clare, how did you arrive at that theory? Was it easy to come by, or I hadn't heard it articulated that way before? Or were, how'd you get it?
Okay, well, I think probably some or many of your listeners are familiar with the peak oil theory. This is a belief that oil, conventional oil anyway, is at or will soon be at a peak in production as measured in barrels per day. How many barrels per day are being produced around the world, that we're at a peak of what the world can produce and will now see a decline. And many people subscribe to this belief, and I did as well. But in studying the behavior of the oil companies, I found that rather than adjust to a world of diminished oil supplies by switching to oil alternatives, what the oil companies are doing instead are pouring money into unconventional or extreme oil. They're pouring money into going deeper offshore and into the Arctic and into Canadian tar sands, another form of unconventional energy, to keep the oil age going longer. And the only way I could describe this is as extreme energy, pushing us to the extremes in order to keep the oil age going longer and the profits rolling in to the big companies like BP and Exxon.
You quoted in an article you have coming out in the Progressive, a Chevron executive basically confessing to this, and I don't know what that document was, whether it was an annual report or what, but he just saying the easy oil's gone and we're going in into tougher and tougher areas.
That's right. That's Dave O'Reilly, the CEO of Chevron. That was an advertisement he took out in the Wall Street Journal and other newspapers. And he said, he put a positive spin on this. You could trust us, big energy companies. We're not going to let you down. Even though the easy oil is gone, we're going to invest a lot of money in new technology to get at this tough oil so that you could go on driving your SUVs or whatever. It was meant to reassure us. But I see it as a very dangerous trend, and this is what led to the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. BP, in particular, made a decision. Well, some of your listeners may recall an advertising campaign about 5 years ago that BP means beyond petroleum, and the former CEO, John Brown, was investing money in energy alternatives, wind and solar and so on. But when Tony Hayward, the company current CEO, took over, he said, no, our profits come from oil and natural gas, and instead of investing in energy alternatives, we're going to go into deep water. That's going to be our route to success and profits. We're going to be the company that digs deeper and further offshore, and we're going to do it in a hurry. And it was this rush to drill ever deeper waters of the Gulf of Mexico, overlooking safety regulations, overlooking environmental regulations. That's what led to the disaster.
And it's amazing after the disaster, after months of the disaster, even if the well is successfully kept capped, that BP itself and other oil companies continue to advocate for deep-sea oil drilling. It's baffling to me.
Well, it shouldn't be baffling, because we're talking about the biggest and richest corporations in the history of humanity. These are mammoth, titanic companies, and their profits come from selling oil and natural gas. And they understand that eventually the world is going to shift towards alternatives to oil, has to shift to alternatives to oil and gas, meaning solar, wind power, other renewables. But they don't want to give up their profits. And so they're doing whatever they can to perpetuate the oil age as long as possible. And they're counting on our addiction to oil to keep them in business. So they've made a calculated decision to prevent change from taking place, to perpetuate the oil age by extreme measures.
And Michael Clare, is that because they don't think they can corner the market on solar and wind?
I think it's for a different reason, Matt. I think it's because of what economists call sunk costs. The money already invested in refineries and gas stations and pipelines and oil tankers. I saw an estimate that this represents $5 trillion of investment in the existing oil infrastructure, and it needs more oil to turn a profit. Someday, somebody is going to make a profit on wind power and solar power, but it's going to take an equivalent level of investment, at least, of $5 trillion. And the oil companies don't want to give up their profits to invest in this new infrastructure. They want the government to do it or somebody else to do it. They want to keep feeding oil into their existing infrastructure, their refineries. So it's a pure economic decision for them.
I'm speaking with Michael Clare. He is the author of Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. He's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. He's the author of The Extreme Oil Theory, which has been vindicated by this BP oil spill. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Michael Clare, the other baffling thing to me, and maybe it shouldn't be baffling either, is that politicians in some of these Gulf states want to keep on doing the offshore drilling, too. How do you explain that?
Well, not only in the Gulf states, let's not forget that President Obama announced on March 31st of this year that he was going to expand the areas open to deep offshore drilling. And I think this reflects a complicated calculation, very complicated politics. On one hand, people in the United States want to reduce our reliance on Middle Eastern oil and foreign oil for very good reasons, because that entails very dangerous foreign policy commitments and obligations, one war after another in the Middle East. President Obama says this out loud. We don't want to be entangled in more overseas, with more overseas oil dictatorships. Fine. I support him on that 100%. But if you're going to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and you don't have in place the energy alternatives that make it possible to reduce our consumption of oil, then you have to replace Middle Eastern oil with something else. And I think that led him to the calculus that in the meantime, we should increase our offshore drilling while we construct the energy alternatives that'll make it possible to reduce our dependence on oil altogether.
I mean,
but the investment in energy alternatives is too little to make progress fast enough. If we're going to be dependent on oil and not get Middle Eastern oil, it means we have to drill at home.
Michael Clare, the amazing thing about that announcement that came out in March was not only that it was terribly embarrassing 3 weeks later when the BP oil spill happened, but that it was a 180-degree turn from one of the courageous things Obama said on the campaign trail, which was we're not going to spoil our pristine coasts and do offshore oil drilling. And he accused McCain of flip-flopping on it, and McCain accused McCain of coming out for offshore oil drilling, and Obama stood his ground there and looked courageous and not pandering, and yet then he gets into power and he changed his mind, because when he opposed it, he said, look, it's not going to help us get that much more energy independent. It's not going to bring down the price of oil. I think he said more than a nickel or a dime over the next 10 years. It was a really strange 180. And it's
I think he's reflecting the paradox of our situation is that the United States is not making swift enough progress towards either the development of energy alternatives, whatever they might be, or in energy conservation by greater reliance on public transit, on more hybrids and all electric cars. The progress is just too slow.
His Obama's response after the oil spill was, in a sense, in his big speech, was to recognize what you've been saying. I think he used the expression that, you know, easy oil is, that era is gone. So he understands that.
Yes.
And yet the response still seems to be too little too late. What kind of investments are needed? What magnitude of investments are needed, Michael Clare?
Oh, my. Well, I would say we have to increase the rate of investment by a factor of 10. You know, he's proposed to spend something, you know, several billion dollars per year on energy alternatives. You have to add a zero to that at the very least if we're going to reduce our dependence on oil at any time soon.
And what do you say to people like Sarah Palin who are in that drill baby drill category still?
Well, what I say to her, what I would say to her is, let's have a discussion about what's in the best interest of the United States and our children. You know, she claims to care about children, our children, and America's children, and the current rate, the current model of energy development in the United States is one that's going to set us backwards in comparison to other countries that are moving more swiftly to develop energy alternatives that are, as in Europe, where I've just been, or Japan, or even China now, because they're investing more heavily in energy alternatives, they're going to capture the next generation of technology that will push them ahead in the world economy. We're going to fall behind in the world economy because of our slow pace of development. Let's face it, energy alternatives, energy efficiency, renewable energy, this will be the leading edge technology of the 21st century. It has to be. And the countries that are ahead in that race are going to be the world leaders of the 21st century. And at the rate we're going, the United States will not be among them.
Is it possible, Michael Clare, that that argument, that economic argument, is going to be more persuasive to some people than the environmental argument?
I believe so. I think in the end that will be the decisive argument because it is one that embraces the well-being of everyone in the country.
Now, you say in this article in The Progressive you have coming out that improved oversight, regulation, et cetera, is not the answer, even though the regulatory oversight of the BP operations there in the Gulf, that oversight was atrocious. Why is improved oversight not the answer?
Well, the reason I say that is because we are on a trajectory in this country towards ever-increasing dependence on extreme energy, further offshore, but other forms of extremes, Arctic oil and gas, unconventional gas like shale gas, Canadian tar sands. This is the trajectory we're on, and all of these entail environmental hazards of different kinds. And so unless we move off that trajectory, we will have more environmental disasters like the one in the BP, like the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico. They may take different form, but they will be of equal magnitude.
Michael Clare, you also say that this isn't just an environmental crisis, but a civilizational crisis. And what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that we are a society, the United States of America in particular, that is oriented around abundant oil, the oil-powered automobile, urban sprawl, and malls, and the whole economic culture of cheap oil. And the era of cheap oil is now over. So trying to perpetuate that dooms us further to economic obsolescence and more economic crises like we have now. We have to move towards a new kind of economy and society based on efficiency, renewables, high-speed rail, and other expressions of a new energy era. Something else also is that our whole foreign policy has been oriented towards the procurement of oil wherever it is, especially the Middle East and Africa. And that's dragged us deeper into foreign wars and pushed up our foreign debt, our national debt, I should say, because the cost of these wars is humongous. So we have to recreate our civilization to fit a extreme tough oil era in which the priority has to be on switching away from oil.
Speaking with Michael Clare, who's the author of Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy, and is the author, the visionary author of the extreme oil theory. I want to get to U.S. foreign and military policy in a second, Michael, but before that, I mean, you're raising some of these issues that I know Bill McKibben and Wendell Berry have talked about, a different way of, in a sense, organizing our society, organizing our economy. They talk about going local, having localized economies, even local energy sources and energy grids. Are those some of the things you're anticipating?
Well, I certainly think in places where that's feasible, that has to be the priority. But the global trend is towards increased urbanization. And I actually think that urbanization is a good thing for energy use because it facilitates mass transit and public transportation and the efficient use of energy. So I think as long as localization isn't perceived, as it sometimes is, as a largely a rural phenomenon, people moving to the country and growing food and so on, that's not practical. We have to think in terms of making cities green and energy efficient. That has to be the priority, actually.
And Michael, you were just in Europe, and they have some cities that are essentially carless cities in Europe, big cities. Have you been to some of those, and how do those function?
Well, you can be in cities like Paris or Barcelona, where I just visited, or Madrid, or Amsterdam, where tremendous progress has been made in reducing reliance on automobiles. But those cities have very efficient public transit systems built up over many years and now being modernized and expanded. So you have to have that. In addition, they doing everything they possibly can to facilitate the use of bicycles. So if you visit Paris or Barcelona, you will see ranks and ranks and ranks of bicycles available for rent at very low cost, and many bike lanes and other bike-friendly moves, streets that only bicycles could ride on and pedestrians and so forth. You need to redesign cities along this line.
So this is green urban planning that's taking place in Europe, not really taking place too much in the United States. So there's some cities, Portland, Oregon, I think Madison, Wisconsin, where I'm from, where they are more or less bike-friendly. But we got a long way to go on that, don't we?
We have a long way to go, but I would sense this is the wave of the future. I think that there's tremendous interest among college students and university students in how to adapt some of those ideas to the United States.
Michael, Claire, tell me if I'm wrong on this. Did you get into this energy field or analysis of the energy field because of your long-term study of U.S. foreign and military policy, or did you get it in a different way?
No, I got into this field because of my interest, long-term interest, Matt, and your magazine has published some of my articles on the international arms trade. I've always been studying how wars are stimulated and sustained by the global trade in weapons and guns. And then I got interested from that in the financing of arms. And once you look at that, you see that the arms trade and the energy trade are closely related. The Middle Eastern oil countries are the biggest purchasers of arms, and the arms manufacturers are very closely dependent on oil kingdoms, and one thing led to another.
And how is this study of the arms trade and brought you to figure out what's wrong with U.S. foreign and military policy, for instance? As you know, you've talked about how our energy dependence is driving U.S. policy here. Would you say the Iraq war was a war for oil, as a lot of us said at the beginning?
Well, I've always said that the war in Iraq is a war for oil, but not for oil as a commodity, but oil as a source of power. And I think you have to make that distinction. The United States fought a war in Iraq because the United States seeks to be the dominant power in the entire Persian Gulf region, which has two-thirds of the world's oil, not necessarily for our own consumption of that oil, because the rest of the world depends on that oil as well. But by being the dominant power in the Persian Gulf, the United States has a stranglehold on the global economy. It's the 21st century equivalent of a nuclear arsenal in the 20th century. So it was very important for the U.S. to eliminate any rivals, and that remains the case today, Iran being the next threat to American dominance in the region that may have to be eliminated one way or another. Saddam Hussein had to go because he posed a threat to American dominance.
Michael Clare, how likely do you think there will be a military clash in Iran, either the United States bombing Iran or Israel bombing Iran?
You know, Matt, I used to think it was much greater than 50%. You know, right now I would say it hovers around 50% because with the tougher economic sanctions now being applied, it may be that the government in Iran, because they're under tremendous pressure from their own public about deteriorating economic conditions in the country, conditions there are getting worse, that they may feel that they have to make some kind of compromise. So, you know, it remains to be seen.
And what about Afghanistan? Where does that fit in as far as energy wars?
No, I don't think the conflict in Afghanistan is primarily about energy per se, but Afghanistan is in a very strategic location as far as energy goes. It lies between the Persian Gulf, which has two-thirds of the world's oil, and it lies near the Caspian Sea Basin, which has about 10% of the world's energy supplies, and it also houses lots of minerals that have become very important suddenly, and it lies near crucial overland pipeline routes. So I think that Afghanistan has a geopolitical significance by virtue of its location.
Michael Clare, we have about 1 minute left, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to the listener who's driving in her car or is in the kitchen or is in his office somewhere, and tell this person what he or she might be able to do.
Well, I think that energy is going to be, in all of its manifestations, including global warming and the economy of the United States, energy is the linchpin for America's future status in the world and well-being in the world. It is crucial. This is what I tell my students. So first thing is that we need to be very smart about energy. What is the energy path that's best for the United States? And understanding, as I believe, that moving away from petroleum is our best interest, then pushing our people in Congress and local people to move us as swiftly as possible in that direction.
Well, that's going to have to be the last word on that. Great advice from Michael Clare, professor at Hampshire College, a real visionary on this extreme oil issue. Michael Clare, thanks for being my guest today.
It's been my pleasure, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.